Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, April 3rd, 2012. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, Moscow City Council approves Phase 2 of Moscow Mountain Reservoir study. Top climate modeler for the Northwest gives his climate predictions for the region. Wild Idaho Rising Tide activist refuses plea deal in air kick case. And unregulated fracking becomes more likely in Payette County. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Whitman County commissioners have set a series of open meetings and a public hearing for later in the month with the intent of resetting or otherwise amending the contract they signed with the developers of the planned Hawkins Company's Mall on the state line at Moscow. The meetings are in reaction to a lawsuit by an ad hoc group called Organization to Void Illegal Conduct, which is made up of Whitman County residents. The lawsuit maintains the county violated the Open Public Meetings Act when they voted January 3rd to increase the amount of infrastructure improvements for the new mall from $9.1 million to $15 million. The agreement would be void unless the developer, the Boise-based Hawkins Companies, opened at least two big-box stores in their 700,000-square-foot shopping mall. So far, the company has not begun construction on the mall and had delayed construction after the economy sank in 2008. Organization to Void Illegal Conduct also says Hawkins Companies is not a registered agent to do business in the state of Washington and that county commissioners illegally agreed to have the county grade some of the construction site. Commissioners scheduled tentative workshops on the issue for Monday, April 9th at 11 a.m. and Tuesday, April 10th at 9 a.m. The public hearing on the issue was scheduled for Monday, April 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Whitman County Public Services Building in Colfax, with the possibility of continuing the public hearing on Tuesday, April 17th, also at 6:30 p.m. Commissioner Greg Parch said the idea is for Hawkins Companies to make a presentation on April 16th, and the next evening the public would comment and commissioners and developers could answer questions. Parch said the reason for the public hearing format is so a vote can be taken afterwards. Parch and Commissioner Patrick O'Neill voted in early January for the new contract, while Commissioner Michael Largent voted against the move. Largent told the Daily News the meetings will be an opportunity for Hawkins Companies to communicate what they would like to see changed in the contract. In other Whitman County news, Commissioner Greg Parch, a Republican from Garfield, announced yesterday he is seeking re-election this year. Parch's three opponents so far are all critical of the Hawkins Company's infrastructure agreement. The opponents are Art Swanick of Lamont, Kirk Seuss of Steptoe, and Bill Tensfeld of Rosalia. The field will be cut down to two candidates in the August primary, with the final vote for the seat Parch holds in November. The woman shot in the abdomen yesterday at the U.S. Route 95 rest area about a mile south of the Benoit County line in northern Latah County told police she may have been shot by a stalker whose identity is unknown to her. The Latah County Sheriff's Office reported today there has been an ongoing investigation by the Pullman Police Department into a stalking incident reported by the woman in that city. The victim is 28-year-old Kayla Sedlasek of Princeton. Sedlasek said the man who shot her was wearing a black ski mask when he shot her in the abdomen with her gun as they struggled after a confrontation in the women's restroom at the rest area just before 4 a.m. yesterday. Based on the stalking investigation and the circumstances surrounding the case, the Latah County Sheriff's Office does not believe there is currently a danger to the general public from the stalker. In Colfax, Superior Court Judge David Frazier set $500,000 in bail yesterday for each of two brothers accused of killing 23-year-old Marcus Schur in December and putting his bullet-ridden body in a stream off Bellsby Road in northern Whitman County. The Lewiston Tribune says Schur is from Malden, Washington, while the Daily News says he is from Rosalia. County Prosecutor Dennis Tracy is seeking first-degree murder charges against 20-year-old Daniel Lascano of Spokane and 24-year-old Frank Lascano. The Lewiston Tribune says Frank Lascano is from Rosalia, while the Daily News says he is from Pine City, Washington. The creek where Schur's body was found runs between Bonnie Lake and Rock Lake. Schur's body was identified by dental records after he was found by a fisherman on Sunday, March 25th. Arraignment for the Lascano brothers is set for Friday in Superior Court in Colfax. Bonner County Prosecutor Lewis Marshall charged former Latah County Sheriff's Lieutenant Rhonda Bunny today with felony misuse of public money for allegedly embezzling $56,000 from three revenue streams she was in charge of over a five-year period. Bunny was fired March 1st from her job of overseeing all administrative functions of the Sheriff's Department, where she worked for 26 years. Latah County announced yesterday it has received most of the misappropriated money missing from county revenues since 2011. Latah County Clerk Susan Peterson said the Idaho County's risk management program paid the county $33,465 after deductibles last month. That state-run insurance program only covers embezzled money for 2 years. In an independent audit last year, Latah County officials discovered over $36,000 in Sheriff's Department revenues missing between October 2009 and October 2011. The forensic audit was conducted by Moscow accounting firm Presnell Gage, which was paid $11,804 for their work. Bunny was at the center of the investigation, which followed. Bunny's job description was supervision of county dispatches, driver's licensing, and all other civil departments under the sheriff's office. Peterson told the Daily News, quote, "It wasn't taken from the budget, it was taken from the revenue. When the funds were misappropriated, they never made it to the county auditor except for the commissary account. That's separate and that's administered by the sheriff's office." If convicted, Bunny would have to pay the remaining 3 years of misappropriated monies and the $33,645 already reimbursed by the insurer, ICRMP. She could also be held accountable for the cost of the audit. The Bonner County Prosecuting Attorney's Office is handling the Idaho State Police criminal investigation report. U.S. District Judge Edward Lodge in Boise ruled today Republican Representative Phil Hart of Athol cannot use legislative immunity in his defense against a federal charge that he has not paid $500,000 in income tax. Lodge ruled the legislative immunity only applies to legitimate legislative activity and not actions taken as a private citizen. Lodge set Hart's trial for November. Hart's state tax case was also before the state Supreme Court this week. Yesterday, the five justices looked skeptically at Hart's argument that he did not have to appeal a state tax commission ruling against him within the usual time limit because the legislature was in session at the time. Hart said the Idaho Constitution has a provision disallowing a civil process against a sitting lawmaker within 10 days of the start of the legislative session and during the session. Hart was given until January 4, 2010 to appeal the $53,000 judgment against him, but did not appeal until 3 months later. The legislative session began on January 14th that year. Deputy Attorney General Bill Von Tagen argued before the state Supreme Court Monday Hart was not being subject to the tax commission process. Quote, "He's availing himself of it. The relevant fact is his appeal time ran out on January 4th, unquote. Justice Warren Jones said he doesn't have to appeal. There is no compulsion. He's not being subject to a process. It's if he chooses to use that process. Hart's attorney Star Kelso argued all civil processes and appeals are included in the constitutional provision. Star said, in order for Representative Hart to protect himself, he would have had to have taken time away from the legislature and have taken an affirmative act. The Federal General Services Administration has told Latah County Commissioners they are asking $1.9 million for the Moscow Federal Building. Latah County Commission Chair Jennifer Barrett said although the three commissioners were compelled to sign a confidentiality agreement before the GSA would release their asking price for the 39-year-old building, the email sent to commissioners last Friday with the asking price in it came with a note that the commissioners could make the number public. Latah County Development Council Director B.J. Swanson said the asking price is too high for the building built in 1972, in part because it needs up to $1.6 million in renovations and modernization upgrades. Swanson, who has been brokering talks with the General Services Administration, said, "I'm not happy with the price." Swanson added, "I'm hoping we can somehow negotiate with them." Commissioner Barrett said the asking price had them surprised, shocked, and awed. She said, "I don't know what else we can call it." Commissioner Dave McGraw said, "At least we have a starting point now." Swanson said she will coordinate a response to the GSA in hopes the price can be lowered to a more manageable number for county taxpayers. She said, "It's already been paid for once with taxpayer dollars." The Moscow City Council last night unanimously approved a professional services agreement with Terragraphics Environmental and SPF Water Engineering for Phase 2 of the Surface Water Reservoir Feasibility Study. The council agreed to the $66,000 contract with the condition that the City Public Works Department negotiate a timeline for the study. Here, Moscow Public Works Director Les McDonald discusses the study to determine if a reservoir on or near Moscow Mountain could help serve the city's municipal water needs in the future.
The study so far has focused on what could be done on Moscow Mountain, what's available, what the topography looks like, what type of candidate sites are out there. But we've had questions asked about, well, what are other possibilities? Certainly ASR is one of those. One possible candidate would be to perhaps pull water out of the North Fork of the Palouse River up near Potlatch, for instance, treat it and bring it over the mountain for use here locally. There are other options that have been reviewed in the past. Corps of Engineers studies back in the 80s looked at pulling water out of the Dorshak reservoir area or out of the Snake River, things of that nature. So this portion of the study would take some of those past reviews and assessments, update the cost estimates to today's dollars, look at some of the other options identified, such as the North Fork option, the ASR options, and then compare all of those to the findings of the first phase of the study, the surface water options on Moscow Mountain. And really just to a general look at all of the options to see how the reservoir possibilities stack up against others.
That was Moscow Public Works Director Les McDonald at last night's Moscow City Council meeting. Since the study will consider all alternatives, Mayor Nancy Cheney took the opportunity to say the aquifer storage and recovery method of providing more water for the community may be dangerous to the aquifers currently used for drinking water in the region.
Opportunity. Anytime Les talks about ASR, I'm going to articulate my strong opposition to that as a solution. I know the City Council Committee chose to pursue that as a for investigation, but given the fact that we as an entire basin rely on the Grand Ronde, that we are looking optimistically at the fact that perhaps some of the decline has slowed with some of our conservation efforts or other variables we may not have identified or understood yet, it would be, I think, ill-advised for us to potentially contaminate that pristine water supply, some 20,000 years old or whatever the latest is, with some of the chemicals that we are not required to test for or treat yet, but we're learning more every day. So I appreciate that the council doesn't want to close any doors to possibilities, but that is one that has unsettled me from the outset. So I'm encouraged that we are pursuing the reservoir feasibility study. I think it'll be a very important means of augmenting and perhaps someday replacing the water supply in the Palouse Basin. But we're not in the world of hurt that some of those other places around the world are facing, where they have desalination units and they have toxic water supplies, where they have no water. We're not in that position yet, and I would say that would be way down on my list.
That was Moscow Mayor Nancy Cheney at last night's city council meeting. $35,231 out of the $66,000 price tag for phase two of the study will be used to, quote, identify and explore potential ASR strategies. City Council member Tom Lamar asked for and received clarification that some of the money used to study aquifer storage and recovery methods would also be used to study the possibility of treating and using water directly out of Paradise Creek. Public Works Director McDonald said it would, but usually methods of collecting water like that also include some sort of storage or recharge options because there is often more water than a municipality can use flowing through at one time, and because storage and recharge can help purify water over time. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP in Moscow. The director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute and the Oregon Climate Services was at the University of Idaho yesterday to give what he thinks are the most likely scenarios for climate change in the Northwest. Philip Moat, who is a professor of physics of oceans and atmosphere, is considered among the top climate model experts in the region. In this four-minute clip, listen carefully as Moat lays out what the Northwest can expect in terms of climate change.
So the main story here is, number one, every single model for both scenarios, and actually there's a third scenario we looked at within the plot here, says that the region will warm by the 2040s compared with the previous century. Number two, out of all the seasons, summer is expected to warm the most. Number three, there's quite a large spread among the model results for regional warming. So there are some where the warming out of this period is only 6 or 7 tenths of a degree Celsius, less than was observed in the 20th century. On the other hand, there are others, especially for summer, where there's warming above 3.5, 4 degrees Celsius. It's on the order of 7 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a lot more than was observed. So a very wide spread in model results. Next thing to note, when we move down to precipitation, the zero line right through here cuts through the spread of scenarios. So the models are quite divided about whether the region will get wetter or drier. And for summertime, especially for the A1B scenario, they're much more excited about the possibility of dry summers. And actually, if we plot the precipitation change and the temperature change as a scatter plot, and these are the symbols B1, A1B, and A2, there's actually a pretty good relationship. The models that say it'll get wetter also say it won't warm very much in the summertime. And the models up here in this corner that say it'll get drier say it'll get a whole lot warmer. Let me talk briefly about NARCAP. This is the domain of NARCAP, North America, at a 50-kilometer resolution, so you can see a little bit of texture now in the mountains, including the interior Columbia Basin and the Cascades. NARCAP is a portfolio of global model runs forcing several different regional climate model runs. And there's some interesting math here. 4 times 6 equals 12, because instead of doing all 24 combinations, each of the folders indicates a combination that was actually run. So for every regional model, there were 2 global models. And then NSEP, if you were particularly astute, you would remember that is related to observations. So all the models did that one. So here are some results of NARCAP changes for the Pacific Northwest, and now we're starting to see some spatial detail because the terrain is now resolved in the model. So this is the difference in the number of days where the temperature is below 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And you can see that for the mountains of Idaho, that metric goes up quite dramatically. The bottom panels just show the base plots whose difference is shown in the top panel. So this is the average number of days that cold in the 1971 to 2000 period, and this is for 2041 to 2070. So very, very strong gradient as we move inland. The western part of the region is so heavily affected by the maritime climate that there's very little change in the number of very cold days. And then you get up to the mountains of Idaho and it's the most. This is the same kind of thing, but it's the length of the frost-free season. And now we see the biggest changes are actually over in western Washington, western Oregon. And again, here are the maps of the baseline and the future. So changes in sort of, 20 to 30 days per year in Idaho. This is the percent change in seasonal precipitation, winter, spring, summer, fall. Notice the average NARCAP result is for a drying of several percent, which is consistent with what we saw for the global modeling. I'll skip this. This is just attempting to put the global modeling and NARCAP on the same field. And then this is the annual number of days of, of extreme precipitation, changes in extreme precipitation. And the largest percentage change is basically in the driest parts of the region. So the NARCAP results suggest some increase in the number of days per year everywhere, but then if you express it as a percentage, the number of days is quite small in the dry areas, so you get a larger percentage change there.
That was Oregon Climate Change Research Institute Director Phil Moat giving a talk at the University of Idaho yesterday on envisioning future climates for the northwestern U.S. KRFP citizen journalist Robert Edgar assisted with this story. The presentation by Moat is part of an ongoing climate change seminar at the University of Idaho, which is hosting speakers every Monday at 3:30 p.m. at various locations through the end of April. On last night's Climate Justice Forum program on KRFP, Payette County anti-fracking activist Alma Haas told how little input she as a homeowner has on fracking and drilling activity near her house since House Bill 464 was signed by Governor C.L. Butch Otter and recent drilling regulations were approved by the state. House Bill 464 prevents city and county governments from regulating most aspects of oil and gas drilling, as well as fracking, in the state of Idaho. The state rules on drilling do not prohibit carcinogenic and toxic chemicals used in fracking and which can affect groundwater. Here's Alma Haas speaking last night on KRFP.
Rules governing oil and gas production that passed about a month prior to 464 passing, those are supposed to be the set of rules that are put in place to protect you and I as Idaho citizens, and to say that they're woefully lacking would be a major understatement. For example, there are no hard and fast requirements. There's no mandatory baseline testing of water wells required when these guys come in and set up shop. The language reads that there will be an opportunity for baseline testing, but it does not say anywhere in those rules that the oil and gas companies must conduct baseline testing prior to drilling those wells. So I'm assuming that the opportunity language would mean that if I hear that Snake River Gas and Oil is going to come and drill a well in my neighbor's property, and I go to them and I say, look, I want you to test my water well prior to your drilling, then at that point they could say to me, okay, well, we hear you talking, Alma. We've given you the opportunity to be heard, but we're not going to do it. It doesn't mandate that they conduct that testing whatsoever. So that to me is very problematic. And Helen, this is something that could be very easily fixed with just some simple language changes in the rules, which we begged for, absolutely begged for, and they would not hear us. We asked for two things in particular. We asked for tracers, for them to mandate the use of tracers in their drilling fluids, drilling muds, any of their things that they were going to be injecting into the ground, so that if there was a problem, we would be able to trace back where that problem originated. Because we could find ourselves in a situation here in Idaho where we have multiple companies drilling multiple wells, and let's say you've got a dozen wells in a two-mile radius, how do you know if there are three companies involved who's causing that groundwater contamination? So if the state were to just do a couple simple things like mandate the use of tracers and mandate baseline water testing, that way if there's a problem, it would be very easy to document what that problem was and more importantly, where it originated, and therefore who was liable for that groundwater contamination. But the industry, nor did our politicians, want to hear any of that. They acted like they'd never heard of such a thing. So, which is another problem I think we have, and this has been driven home to me during this process, that our voices, your voice and my voice, neither one of us, we're not heard. Not only are we not heard, but more infuriating than that, they set up this process under the so that everybody assumes that they actually have a voice and that their voice actually means something. Well, I'm here to tell you, after having sat through six bills on oil and gas legislation and some very questionable behavior on some of our lawmakers by not disclosing that they had gas leases, we might as well have just been talking to a brick wall. There was absolutely no consideration for what we wanted. I begged Senator Pierce, sent several emails to him, asking him if he would allow us the opportunity to bring in a water expert from New York City, from New York State, a hydrogeologist who's very familiar with gas drilling and its impacts on groundwater and the contamination issues that they're dealing with quite a bit back there. And he never even returned my email. Yet at the same time, the gas and oil industry had their lobbyists in there, their attorneys in there. Anytime they wanted to pop in and give an hour and a half presentation to the committee, they were given carte blanche. We, on the other hand, couldn't even get an email returned, nor would they allow us to bring in our expert to dispute what the industry was telling those lawmakers.
And having listened to a few of these hearings online, I remember most folks were constrained to only about 3 minutes, and very rarely were experts deferred to. Could you tell us a little bit about perhaps why, regarding conflicts of interest and ethics investigations and such, our elected officials both at the county and the state level might not be listening to citizens as much as the seeing the dollar signs in their own eyes?
Certainly. Well, in the case of at the state level, Senator Pierce, who's our District 9 senator, he voted 22 times before he disclosed that he had signed an oil and gas lease. And he voted on a total of six different bills and never disclosed in committee. And he's the chairman of the Senate Resources Committee, where all of this legislation came through. And, in fact, I learned something very interesting through this process, Helen. I had originally had some questions, but he had said in a couple public meetings that he was offended that we had even suggested that maybe he had some financial ties, and he did such a good job of convincing us that he didn't. I didn't do the research and look for his leases until at some later point. But what happened was he actually, by disclosing in the 11th hour, I went and found that he actually had a lease that he signed back on November 15th of 2011. 2011, before any of this legislation came through his committee.
And that was Payette County anti-fracking activist Alma Haas speaking on KRFP's Climate Justice Forum program on KRFP with host Helen Yost. The show airs Monday nights from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Wild Idaho Rising Tide activist Helen Yost, who's also a KRFP talk show host, has turned down a plea agreement to which would have allowed her charge of attempted battery on a police officer to be dropped, stemming from an event where she air-kicked in the direction of a Moscow police officer as the last of more than 70 ExxonMobil tar sands shipments passed through Moscow on March 6th. Yost is also facing a charge of throwing an object at a moving vehicle after she threw a cardboard sign at the back of the last megaload as it passed through town, which weighed 415,000 pounds. The incident happened at the corner of 3rd and Washington Street on the same night. Yost spoke to KRFP citizen journalist Polly D about her court hearing earlier today.
They're both misdemeanors. The first is throwing a substance at a vehicle moving on a highway, that was in relation to the tossing of a sign at the megalode. And then the second charge, also a misdemeanor, was, on the record at least, and I don't know the code for either of these misdemeanors, was attempted battery of a peace officer. I apparently, at least on the ticket that was written for me, attempted to kick a police officer. That the prosecutor, Rod Hall, agreed to dismiss if I pled guilty to the sign-throwing charge. And he said that that offer was only available today. And after discussing the situation with my attorney, Ben Onosco of the Northern Rockies Justice Center, the same attorneys that have represented many of the protesters here in Moscow, we decided that there was still a wide variety of ways to go about this, besides just very bluntly and rapidly taking on a guilty plea immediately. There's a lot of other options that could be discussed and considered. And so we didn't want to rush in that rapidly. And my attorney told the prosecutor that I was did not want to make a decision today on that. And so we don't know if he'll make that offer again, in that he did say that offer was only available today. We suspect that that very likely that's not... The situation with the attempted battery is would never make it through trial, since my First Amendment rights were abridged if they say that I can't make a simple gesture such as I did and not have that be misinterpreted as, you know, some kind of assault or battery, and I don't know the difference between the two, on a peace officer, since there was no intent of any kind of violence on my part. So we suspect that that particular ticket, although it is the weightier one, has the higher penalties and probably the worst marks potentially on one's record, it wouldn't be able to stand the light of day in court just because of the situation around it. So
there was actually video taken of that, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a Moscow police officer pretty close by that was taking videos of all of us. And we don't know what all is in that video, and we likely will ask for discovery.
But if we were to look at that video
closely, that's if it could be seen.
We wouldn't see you actually threatening or assaulting a police officer,
no,
would we?
Certainly not at all, in that was not the intent, and so physically I'm sure that was not the expression either. And I'm also quite certain that the distance between me and the officer at that time was enough that there was no possibility that I could have physically represented a threat.
So would you say that particular charge was just a form of intimidation or harassment?
Perhaps, or it could just be that with it being such a public gesture, And, you know, me having stated that, you know, I did make that gesture in public places like Facebook, that they felt that they had to hold up the authority of the law. And you know, it's more or less backlash against free expression. And I under those terms, it wouldn't withstand scrutiny in court. The other misdemeanor, you know, they want me to plead guilty on. There are a number of options still available besides just a straight plea, guilty plea. And so that's the primary reason why I didn't want to close out on those options.
And that's the charge of assaulting the megalode or whatever.
With the 6-ounce sign, that 415,000-pound megalode, you can see the juxtaposition of harm there. We hope that, you know, here's this giant piece of equipment that's going to wreak havoc on the place where it's used, as well as the people in the area affected, as well as the global climate. And I'm throwing a tiny little 6-ounce sign at it that's worded to the effect that if one load is able to use this alternative transportation route, many other companies will follow. So it was my gesture of saying on behalf of the group and out of complete frustration that we won't stand idly by, as we've been forced to, on the sidewalks with our protest signs, while, you know, even the last of these loads comes through our town, or while the company shipping these loads through consider this route again for future shipments, or while other companies do the same. We don't want our small town that is very sustainability oriented to have these companies trample it, both our rights and our infrastructure, with the mechanisms that forward the very exact opposite interactions with nature and the earth that we embrace with our practices here in town. So in other words, if you're going to do right by the world that you live in and the people and all the creatures in it that you care about, then you can't simply embrace sustainable practices in your own life and let others, corporations or neighbors, coworkers, family, continue to do the damage that we do collectively as a culture. And making free expression of that insistence that all entities do right may be unlawful sometimes, such as throwing a 6-ounce sign at a 415,000-pound, you know, piece of death machinery. So
what you're going through right now is really has to do with freedom of speech issues.
Yeah, and right and wrong beyond the law.
Okay. And so what resulted today? What happened?
I decided not to take the offer first put forward by the prosecutor. There'll be another pretrial hearing on April 17th. We don't know what offer the prosecutor will bring forward at that time.
And at this time, do you have any idea what you will be approaching the table with?
I don't. It was a very spontaneous action on my part, and so I can't still completely explain it to myself why I did what I did. It was out of frustration in that, you know, it was the end of the wrongdoing happening in our town, and we were unable to stop it, and we wanted to with all our hearts. So you do what you do sometimes just to make the point.
Okay. Well.
And so I have no idea, you know, whether I'm going to take this to trial or not. I am, you know, I am somewhat disturbed that of us 12 arrestees, none of us have pursued it through the court when, you know, beyond the structures of law, we knew we were all right in what we did. But we all pled guilty because that's the way the system works. And we all, therefore, became victims of the system that we were actually fighting. And we shouldn't perhaps have so so meekly, you know, gone beyond, you know, these incidents that maybe we should have carried forward and fought a little more. But, you know, you can't, as an organizer and a leader of a movement, you can't ask people to do any more than they're willing to do, especially when, you know, when their lives, their criminal records, their jobs, whatever are on the line. They've already done very courageous acts getting in the road, and people need to do what they need to do to take care of themselves. But at the same time, if it's not just, you know, this corporate venture of moving humongous machinery up to a place that's the biggest industrial project on Earth. You know, if you can't fight just that without also fighting the system that facilitates that. And so I would posit that we all need to fight as hard as we can, you know, and give up as much as we can, because there's a lot of people that aren't caring and aren't doing what we're doing, and we need to make up for them as well if we really are intent on doing right.
That was Wild Idaho Rising Tide activist Helen Yost of Moscow speaking with KRFP citizen journalist Polly D earlier today. Yost said this morning she would not at this time take a plea agreement offered by the city prosecutor, which would have dropped battery on a police officer charges in exchange for a guilty plea for throwing an object at a moving vehicle during the last of dozens of megalode protests as ExxonMobil tar sands shipments came through Moscow en route to the Alberta tar sands on March 6th. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Take a look at the weather. There is a winter weather advisory for tomorrow. Rain before 2 a.m. tonight, then snow, 90% chance of precipitation. Snow level 6,200 feet, lowering to 2,600 feet after midnight, low 34. South winds 10 to 14 miles an hour, becoming west. Half an inch of new nighttime snow accumulation possible. Tomorrow, 2 to 4 inches of snow possible, 100% chance of snow, high 41, west winds 15 to 20, gusts up to 30 miles per hour. On Wednesday night, there will be a 40% chance of snow showers, mainly before midnight, mostly cloudy, low 28, southwest wind 5 to 15, gusts up to 25, less than half an inch of snow possible. On Thursday, 40% chance of snow showers afternoon. Some thunder also possible, mostly cloudy, high 41. Little or no snow accumulation expected. 30% chance of snow showers Thursday night, mainly before midnight. Some thunder possible, mostly cloudy, low 30 degrees. Less than half an inch of snow possible. And on Friday, a chance of snow showers before noon, then a chance of rain and snow showers. 50% chance of precipitation. Some thunder possible, mostly cloudy, high 41. New snow accumulation, less than half an inch possible. Currently, a few clouds, 58 degrees in Moscow. Thanks for tuning into the KRFP Evening Report. Remember, if you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow. 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis. Robert Edgar and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow. Change Surfer Radio will return next week in the 6 to 6:30 time slot. We've got Flashpoints coming up in just a moment, and then Music with Gary Land starts out the evening of music all through the evening here at KRFP Moscow 92.5.